Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 24th of October. It's All Things Political, which you always hear Mondays at 9. And because there is so much international news the last couple days, we thought that we would go to Professor Charles Lipson, who teaches international relations at the University of Chicago, as our guest. President Obama announced Friday that all American troops would return from Iraq by the end of the year. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said over the weekend that the U.S. would continue its training mission with Iraq. We have questions about what that mission is. What kind of American presence will there be in Iraq? She also warned Iran, saying they should not misread the withdrawal of American troops as affecting the U.S. commitment to democracy. What about the comment from Afghan President Hamid Karzai that if the U.S. and Pakistan ever went to war, his country would back Islamabad? And leaders of 27 European Union nations have been meeting in Brussels dealing with the problems of the Greek debt, the bailout fund, which is in need of reinforcement, the crisis in the eurozone reaching very worrisome levels. So those are a few things on our agenda this morning with Professor Charles Lipson. He does research with international cooperation and conflict with political aspects of the world economy. His most recent book on international relations is Reliable Partners, How Democracies Have Made a Separate Peace. He writes extensively on international trade, debt, and investment. And his most recent work deals with the problems of forging international cooperation after the Cold War. He's writing about the sources of international order in the 19th and 20th century. And he has also written extensively about education and academic integrity. He wrote a book that has been widely read, Doing Honest Work in College, How to Prepare Citations, Avoid Plagiarism, and Achieve Real Academic Success. We'll be welcoming phone calls. It's a fairly big thing to announce the withdrawal of troops from Iraq. We've been covering that story for years and years now, so I would imagine you'll have a few comments on that and some of the other topics. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And I guess our email is up and running now, so if you'd like, it is not up and running. Okay, so just use the phone, all right? Professor Charles Lipson, a pleasure to speak with you again, sir. Good morning.
Good morning, Kathleen. How are you?
Well, I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. It's amazing how many important stories you were able to list on the international scene.
There are lots of them.
We could go on. If you had more time, you could go on and list more.
I know. Well, maybe we'll get to them during the course of the hour. Let's start with the announcement that American troops would return from Iraq by the end of the year. That there was some kind of negotiation, which I wasn't clear about, that we maybe wanted to stay a little bit longer, but the negotiations fell apart. What's that all about?
The story that was widely reported in the press was that the U.S. was willing to leave troops. Various numbers had been bandied about, but general numbers were in the 3,000 to 10,000 range, and I think it was more like 3. But the U.S. would only leave the troops if those troops were granted diplomatic immunity. Why did you need diplomatic immunity? Because, let's say we're shooting at a terrorist or something like that. Then that person, the U.S. soldier, could be tried in an Iraqi court if he didn't have diplomatic immunity. The one thing that diplomats can do is simply say, we can be tried at home by our own court. So what was really involved was the idea that our soldiers there would not be subject to local Iraqi courts and justice, whatever that meant. I think there's a backstory to that, Kathleen.
What's the backstory?
I think that there are really two important issues. One is after the government that was formed took a long time to form in Iraq and ended up basically with a strong Shia sectarian emphasis. In the government, there was there were two big parties. One was more secular and one was more religious. We didn't really get involved in pushing very hard for the more secular of the two to lead the government. The more religious one ended up with a lot of support from some religious extremists who had backing from Iran. So that's problem one. So one of the guys involved is Muqtada al-Sadr, who spent a lot of time in Iran, who's a radical figure. The second problem is that the military in the United States wanted to leave more troops there, not a large number, but perhaps as many as 25,000 to do the training, because you not only need to do training, you need to have U.S. troops to protect the ones who are doing the training, because there will potentially be assaults on them. So when we offered only to leave a very small number there, the Iraqis basically didn't like that number. Some say were insulted by the number, thought that it meant that the U.S. was abandoning them, and rather than take a small number, they in fact forced our hand. Those are the stories that I think lie behind this diplomatic immunity. But the real, but why should anybody who's living in Wisconsin, northern Illinois, listening to this, be concerned about it? The real problem is that Iran is the big power in the region. What has kept the smaller powers, Saudi Arabia and Iraq, from being potentially coerced by Iran has been U.S. support, pressure, backing to deter Iran. If the U.S. is not going to play that role in Iraq, will that mean that Iran plays a larger role, not only through its Shiite connections in Iraq, but also simply because there's no U.S. counterweight in Iraq?
And when you say a larger role, what are you talking about?
Well, they have a big role as outside supporters of some of the political parties, the more radical political parties there. But it's also the case that they will be making all sorts of offers, pushing all sorts of diplomatic initiatives and the like. And the question is, are they going to get pushed back from a weak Iraq, or are they going to get essentially a quiet or supportive Iraq that's not pushing back against them? Will they become the uncontested big power in the region? And the country that's most worried about that, I would say, is Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm. When Secretary of State Clinton said that Iran should not misread the withdrawal of American troops as affecting the U.S. commitment to Iraq's democracy, what is our commitment to that democracy?
I don't know. I don't think anybody does. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can say we have that commitment, but what does that really mean? If, especially if we really have pulled out our troops. By the way, it's not just the Iranians that are a potential problem here. There's a large Kurdish population in the north of Iraq, and that Kurdish population crosses the border into Turkey. And in fact, there's a large number of people who live within the country of Turkey who are Kurdish. And the Turks have often wanted to put troops into Iraq to control that Kurdish population to prevent any potential separatism within Turkey. With U.S. forces there, they've been reluctant to do it, but now with U.S. forces out, they may do it. In short, a lot of the issues that we thought a couple of years ago after the surge was successful, that at great cost and in blood and treasure had finally been sort of clawed back in Iraq, or I would say at least possible dangers. Now, I'm not saying that those will necessarily become catastrophic problems. They may not. But I think that a position of the United States to influence events in Iraq is really moving toward an unprecedented low. The good news for the Obama administration is that they have kept their campaign promise that they will be pulling out all the U.S. troops in Iraq, and they'll be doing it by the end of the year. The bad news is that once events there begin to happen, and some may happen in a bad way, if they happen in a bad way, I think that we're in a very weak position to respond.
Mm-hmm. What have we achieved there, Professor Lipson?
Well, the most obvious thing is that we took out Saddam Hussein. And Saddam Hussein was a challenging figure to the United States, mostly because he was challenged. He was a kind of rogue, politician who had tried to take over Kuwait. We'd had to roll that back, and so forth. We were containing him militarily before the war, but the containment process was gradually breaking down. So the most important thing was that it was breaking down because it required help from a lot of other countries, and they didn't really want to continue participating. So we took him out, but the process of establishing a stable pro-American, anti-Islamic Iranian presence after there looked like it reached its high point a couple of years ago and has now faded. So I'm not sure that we've accomplished very much, and we did spend $1 trillion on it.
$1 trillion. Hard to imagine. Is this a war we should have waged?
I think in retrospect, that's one of those issues that's going to be debated for a very long time, very much like Korea and Vietnam, and I think that the answer to that will depend upon the questions that you asked earlier. If what we get ultimately is something like Korea, where you have a stable government that wasn't overrun by the North only because the United States came in and prevented the North from winning in 1950, then you end up with a stable country that ends up growing and ends up becoming part of our broad free world, then that's one thing. But remember, that's required U.S. troops on the ground in South Korea as a deterrent against North Korea and, in an earlier period, against China for many, many years. They're still there. If, on the other hand, what happens in Iraq is sectarian violence, Sunnis trying to come back in by violence, or Iran playing a bigger role, either directly in Iraq or in the region as a whole, if we get fighting involving the Kurds in northern Iraq, then I think everybody, including the people who initially backed the war, will say it wasn't worth it, although some will blame Bush for starting it in the first place, and some will blame President Obama for snatching defeat out of the jaws of victory, as they will call it. So that's the debate to come.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Afghanistan for a moment before we go to phone calls. President Karzai saying in a interview with Pakistani television, if fighting starts between Pakistan and the U.S., we are beside Pakistan. If Pakistan is attacked and the people of Pakistan need Afghanistan's help, Afghanistan will be there with you. Well, I'm sure the America really didn't want to hear that. What were those comments, and what kind of reaction has he had from other people in Afghanistan?
Well, those were shocking comments. If you're an American, and given how much time and effort and blood and treasure we put in there, and how many Americans have had to spend parts of their lives in Central Asia, and sadly how many have come back either in coffins or come back with missing limbs or the like, it's just shocking comments. But let's understand why that kind of comment would be made by a political survivor, a guy who, in this bloody country where people are constantly being assassinated, why he would make it. And the basic answer is that Pakistan really played a critical role in setting up the Taliban to begin with. Why did Pakistan want to do that? Well, it's partly because they have Islamists, especially in their version of the CIA, which is called the ISI. But the other reason is strategic. They view themselves as facing a very large opponent, India, on one side, and what they didn't want was any problems on the other side of them, behind them, in Afghanistan. So they played a critical role in helping set up the Taliban and creating favorable relations with the Taliban. Once we've decided that we're going to pull out of Afghanistan, which we are also doing, and given that we're giving dates certain and we're definitely getting out and so forth, if what's going to happen will be a potential destabilization of Afghanistan because there'll be rising power from the Taliban. So the Taliban will be connected to the intelligence and Islamist resources in Pakistan. If the United States ends up fighting more against Pakistan, that's precisely who will be fighting in Pakistan. So what you see is a guy in Afghanistan saying, look, if the United States ends up fighting the Islamists and the sources in Pakistan that are most connected to Afghanistan, we'll end up standing with those resources in Pakistan, because otherwise those resources in Pakistan and Afghanistan would try to overthrow me. That's, I think, what's behind it. There may be something else, but I think that that's his calculation.
Yeah. And before we go to calls, I keep asking this question, but I have a hard time understanding. We've been there so long now. 10 years is a long, long time. When you talk about potential destabilization, isn't the country pretty unstable as it is?
You bet. You bet. It's really a tribal society. And it's been, and the people who are ruling out in many of the provinces are local warlords. What we've really tried to do is go in and ensure that those warlords and the local powers that be were not on the side of terrorist forces that would come in and set up terrorist camps that could attack the U.S. and Western interests around the world. We don't have any chance, I think, in Afghanistan of setting up a government that would look anything like the kinds of governments that we like around the world. Again, I'll use the South Korean example. So the question is, what are realistic objectives? And frankly, I think that the only realistic objective in Afghanistan and in many other places is to have a government that is not aggressively anti-American, and most important of all, is not setting up, is not being used as a base where groups can set up that would really attack us and our interests outside of that country. That's our main interest. There was a big debate within the administration. Joe Biden and a number of other people within the administration really wanted to wage the kind of war that we've been waging in Yemen, namely a kind of high-technology war with drones. And my hunch is that that's what we'll be moving back to.
We welcome phone calls, and we'll take them momentarily for our guest this hour. You're listening to All Things Political on the Ideas Network. Professor Charles Lipson teaches international relations at the University of Chicago, and he frequently gives talks on international issues and consults with senior government officials, diplomats, and corporate leaders. He has chaired several major programs at the university and is founding director of the Program on International Politics, Economics, and Security security, where faculty and students and people from all over the world come to the University of Chicago to study international cooperation and conflict. Here's our phone number. There is a lot of international news, which is why we're focusing on that this hour. But of course, he can go beyond that. He's a professor of political science. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is the number. And our email is up and running. So that is talk@WPR.org. Talk@WPR.org. The president announcing Friday that all American troops would return from Iraq by the end of the year. What do you think about that? I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program, we're going to be talking about Cleopatra, the search for the last queen of Egypt, which is now at the Milwaukee Public Museum. Chrissy and Rhonda and I had a chance to see it last Friday. It's really Thursday. Really very well done. And it's amazing all that they've found from 2,000 years ago and more fairly recently. Huge statues found in the sand and in the Mediterranean. So we'll be talking about Cleopatra and that time in history and what they've found and the exhibit. Hour number two, our guest will be the department head and curator of ancient history at the Milwaukee Public Museum. He's also an archaeologist who has done digs all over the world. All right, let's go to phone calls. Let's go to Ray in River Falls. Hi, Ray.
Well, good morning. I wanted to ask the professor about the Iran-Iraq situation. And wondering, you know, first, if we were the ones that deposed the Iraqi government that was previously the effective counterweight to Iran, do we really have a right to then complain that there's no effective counterweight? And, you know, seeing that we deposed the democratic government in Iraq or in Iran to install the Shah, can we really holler about democracy in that part of the world? And finally, when Ronald Reagan openly supplied weapons to Iraq in its battle against Iran, but then covertly supplied Iran with Stinger and cruise missiles as a result of the hostage exchange, can we really expect to be trusted in that part of the world?
Those are all great questions. I think underlying them is the idea that there is some hypocrisy in not only U.S. policy, but in international diplomacy more generally. And I think the answer to that is a resounding yes. There certainly is. There's that wonderful scene we all remember, or at least those of us of a certain age remember, in the movie Casablanca, where the French police chief is in the casino, and he says, "I'm shocked to find gambling going on here," in the midst of which he receives his winnings from
right,
playing in the casino. So there's an element of that. But I don't think that that's an element that should stop us from thinking about what our strategic interests are. And I think on these strategic interests, so I don't think for the fact that we help depose a democratic leftist regime in the early 50s that at the time had support from a communist party that we thought would ultimately ally them with the Soviet Union in the midst of the Cold War means that we can't play any role in Iran going forward. I think that the big issues there are that when there was a really large Green Revolution uprising a couple of years ago, President Obama made an important strategic choice, which was that we would not back them, either because we thought, probably because we thought they were unlikely to win, and because we thought we had a chance of diplomatic engagement with the Islamicist regime that is running Iran right now. That really has proven to be a failure. The engagement has proven to be a failure. So I think what you're hearing around the world right now is a lot of praise for the Obama administration for its success in taking out Osama bin Laden, al-Awlaki in Yemen, and now the, quote, leading from behind in Libya, where all of which we've had success at relatively low costs in taking these out. But I think in the case of Iraq, the idea that they would be a counterweight, the question you raised, was something that was always going to involve some U.S. presence there backing the Iraqi government. And now we're removing that, so we're compounding the problem there. So I think this is one of those things that is really dangerous going forward.
Thanks, Ray. We haven't talked about Libya. Here's an email from Bonnie in Madison. Amid all this crowing over the death of Gaddafi, it ought to be remembered that the U.S. and NATO's response to the Egyptian uprising against Mubarak was much slower, as he was a valuable asset. It seems there are useful dictators and those like Gaddafi who are anything but.
Well, that's right. The basic story dictators through the Cold War, for example, was that we would have preferred democracies, but we would have preferred an anti-communist, even right-wing dictator instead of a regime that would potentially ally with the Soviet Union. So we would have preferred a dictator who was anti-democratic rather than a democratic pro-communist dictator. And we still make those kinds of choices. We still have often wanted, but we're ambivalent. We want democracies, and by the same token, we want pro-American regimes. And when we face a choice between the two, we're not sure which direction to go. Let me say something about Libya, but I want to say it in the context of something that didn't get much attention yesterday, which is Tunisia's election. I was in Tunisia this summer only briefly, but and I was struck by how little you saw in terms of women in hijabs and women who were covered and the like. It seemed the parts that I was in seemed to have a fairly large secular presence. But there were something like 100 parties that were running in this new democracy. That was an indigenous revolution. They overthrew the longtime dictator. He fled the country. There was about a year's worth of social activity on the ground there. Now they've had elections, and the winner in the elections, where there were more than 100 parties running, were the Islamicists, and we don't know what they're going to impose. We're fearful in Egypt that we could end up with Sharia law. Mm-hmm. So there's a real possibility of bad outcomes, or at least anti-American outcomes, outcomes that will make life difficult for the United States in that entire region. And that's the real concern in Libya. Libya is a cobbled-together country, and a fairly recently cobbled-together country, of three regions, one around Misrata, one around Tripoli, and one kind of around the area where we finally got Gaddafi Sirte in that area. And there's a question about whether those three will stay together. It's a tribal country. There's a question about the role of the Islamicists, just as there is in Egypt. So I would say that this whole region is roiling, and the outcome over the short to medium term is quite unknown, and indeed the outcome over the longer term is unknown. There haven't been any stable democracies in the whole region. There are strong Islamicist forces. The nationalist forces, which were dominant in the late 50s and through the 60s under Nasser and others, those have been pushed back and defeated. So we don't know what the future what the sort of broad trajectory of the future will be in these Islamic countries that are overthrowing their dictators.
And how long will it be before we know what kind of government will be formed in those countries?
I think that we'll know we'll know sooner in some countries like Egypt than in other countries like Syria. The news in Syria, quietly over the weekend, there have been huge riots in Syria, and there have been mass killings by the Assad regime, which has been in power for quite a long time. The father, Hafez, has now been succeeded by his son after his death, and that regime is a minority sectarian group called the Alawites. The whole army is Alawite. They fear that if the regime goes, their sect will be vulnerable, and so the army is definitely sticking with, they're all going to hang together is what they fear, so they want to hang together. And they're really killing the opposition. Over the weekend, the United States quietly withdrew its ambassador. This wasn't a big signal, we're withdrawing our ambassador because we don't like you. In fact, Obama, we had withdrawn our ambassador earlier under Bush. Obama sent back the ambassador hoping we could engage with the Syrians until about 6 months ago. We kept saying that this thug Assad was actually a potential reformer. He was a reformer. We were backing him. Turns out he was just a killer and a thug. And what they've been doing was encouraging attacks on the U.S. embassy and encouraging attacks on the ambassador, potentially even trying to kill the ambassador, and this weekend we quietly withdrew him. So if you're Assad, you have to look at a dead Gaddafi found in a culvert in a ditch, mm-hmm. and killed. You have to look at this and say, boy, I hope that's not the ghost of Christmas future.
Oh my. Ann in Milwaukee, hi. Ann, hello? Well, we'll put you on hold. I know you've waited for a while. I'm not sure you're still there. Victor in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hello. Good morning. Good morning to your guest.
Thank you, Victor.
I have a question concerning the drug trade, particularly in Central Asia, particularly in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And I'm wondering, is Pakistani intelligence involved somehow with the drug trade, because especially with opium? Because that's how they're bankrolling, buying these weapons. You're wondering, how are they getting these weapons constantly? We already understand the ISA has an involvement with it, and can it be controlled? The other point I like to make is, often we as Westerners, we view democracy as it should happen over there, but we forget these people view the world through Islamic eyes, and we just don't seem to understand that. You know, what works here in Western societies may not work well over there.
Victor, I couldn't agree with you more. I think that you put your finger on some very serious problems. The first is that our view of democracy is a view of liberal, tolerant democracies that have a kind of stable social basis. And what if you end up with intolerant, sectarian, divided democracies, not just in which they're have a strong religious presence, but where the religious presence doesn't tolerate any divisions or doesn't tolerate women going to elementary school or whatever it might be. So I think our notion of democracy as something that simply involves a vote, the vote is insufficient. Voting is the easiest part of democracy. It's building a real civil society in which ordinary people can speak freely, can organize. All those things are really hard. And what I would say is that if we're going to be committed to doing that because we think our real national interests are at stake, that's a long, hard process. If our national interest in a country like Afghanistan or Libya or wherever it might be are simply keeping the bad guys from setting up camps that can attack us, we can do that with many fewer boots on the ground, more technology, and a lot lower cost. Your point about the drug trade is also important, and I would say the following. When you set up terrorist groups with underground cells and the rest, the group not only has to fund itself, it's already developed the capabilities for moving things around surreptitiously, and it can translate many of those capabilities into self-funding drug operations. Of course, the big international issue that we haven't talked about because we're focusing on the Middle East is the war between drug gangs in Mexico, which threatens to spill over our own border and has already made the southern border even more dangerous and contentious. But we do have a drug problem in the United States. The big drug problem is that we're a large consumer. On our southern border, what's happened is that the big money, of course, is in cocaine. It used to come in by air and sea from Colombia into South Florida. We've cut off that route. Now it's coming in by land through Mexico, and the different gangs in Mexico are fighting very hard to control that profitable trade, one gang taking on the other gangs.
Thanks, Victor. Ann in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Thanks.
Thank you.
Are you there?
We're here. Yeah.
Oh, okay, good. I'm not so much about not what happened, but our reaction to it. I'm still thinking about the killing of Gaddafi and even Osama bin Laden. It's how I think we reacted to it, with positive glee and jubilation. And that's appropriate to the acts, to what those men did. But they still... It's disturbing to think that we are only glad without anything more when we get to kill somebody. And then I didn't look, but I understand his face was bloodied and he was face down. And those are pretty strong images. And then in a refrigerator, I don't think it's unpatriotic to say that those are sad things. And I hope I'm not going to be misunderstood by anybody when I say that I have no sympathy with the men.
Right.
But it was their act. They were humans. It was their act that we hate. And that's really all I have to say.
Thank you, Ann.
I think that your comments stand for themselves. I didn't misunderstand what you're saying. You're saying that we want to take out bad people, but the idea of glee, even when you take out bad people, somehow is unseemly because they're a human being. I would say that in the case of Gaddafi, I think what the U.S. was concerned, that it seemed to be an out-of-control kind of group on the ground. I imagine we were also relieved that there wasn't going to be this long trial. And the reason we were relieved about that is one of the most dangerous things is you don't want to see a kind of rallying of people around him. But remember what happened in Iraq after we did capture Saddam Hussein and we were in control. We took him aside and together with the Iraqi government, which was then under greater American control, he was given a trial. Now, ultimately, some photos were sneaked out of that, but they were not sneaked out by the Americans. We wanted no photos to come out of that. And in the case of Osama bin Laden, we wanted a burial at sea. We did not want the triumphalism that went with showing pictures of him. I thought that the way that President Obama handled that in his speech was exactly right, just perfect. It was a somber speech. It said that at long last we've done this. We praise the special forces team. There wasn't any dancing on the grave. Your point is well taken, Ann.
Mm-hmm. More phone calls in a moment. You're listening to All Things Political here on the Ideas Network, and our guest, who joins us fairly often, Professor Charles Lipson, teaches international relations at the University of Chicago. He deals with international cooperation and conflict and with political aspects of the world economy, and we have a lot of international news, of course, to talk about, so that's our focus. But it doesn't have to be exclusively news from everywhere else. Although we do need to get to the Eurozone before this hour is over. If you want to talk politics in this country, that's A-OK as well. 800-486-8655 is our number. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program, Cleopatra. It stopped at the Milwaukee Public Museum, the third spot on an international tour. Carter Lupton, archaeologist and department head and curator of ancient history at the Milwaukee Public Museum, will guide us through the exhibit, which is going to be there until April, end of April. More phone calls for Professor Lipson. I do want to tell you that he's got this really neat website, too. If you go to Charles Lipson, that's Charles Lipson, L-I-P-S-O-N, altogether.com. He has a website that's got news on Iraq, terrorism, Israel, Palestine, Afghanistan, India, and Pakistan. Breaking news is there. He's got culture, politics, and humor. Look at his work and the courses that he offers. And also information, if we've never really talked to him very much about academic honesty, there's material on that as well. So a valuable website for you. Let's go next to Janice in La Crosse or near La Crosse. Hi, Janice.
Hi, good morning. Thank you, Kathleen, and your guest. I appreciate this program. However, honestly, it makes me almost nauseated just listening to all this. For me, it is just so much emphasis on war, you know, destruction, killing, you know, how do we get these guys, how do we, you know, for our benefit and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, no, why the 21st century? Like I said, haven't we evolved away from war and killing? Why aren't we working toward peace? Because to me, what you think about is what you get. And to me, we need to focus on peace, not killing, you know, not war, not taking these people down, not destroying the center of the of civilization over there in Iraq and Iran, you know, the whole area. It's like Afghanistan. Let's try to help these people the best we can. I mean, I don't know. I would rather build up countries and work toward helping them restore their dignity and get these people back together on Earth here. Thank you.
Thank you for the call. Professor Lipson.
I appreciate those comments, Janice. Let me engage them in two ways. The first is that some of the most pernicious wars are actually civil wars. That was certainly true in our own country, right? So simply avoiding an American presence or a European presence or a Chinese presence, an external presence in some country doesn't necessarily mean that there will be peace there. Often there will be much more vicious war, or there'll be a kind of dictatorship. We need not have been involved in the Korean War. North Korea invaded South Korea. We know what kind of a vicious dictatorship it is. It was at the time backed by both Communist China and the Soviet Union. And well, that war would have ended very quickly had we not been involved. But then what would have happened to those people? It wouldn't have been the kind of peace that we have in Wisconsin and Illinois. It would have been a very deep and repressive peace. And the second thing is that even at the international level, the problem is often that if good people avoid thinking about these problems of war, they don't get peace. What they get is sometimes a bigger war, even if they don't want it. In the 1930s, a lot of British citizens, remembering how awful the First World War had been, passed various resolutions, resolved we will not fight for king and country, was the most famous, passed at an Oxford debate. And the result of that was that Hitler, instead of being stopped very early when he could have been stopped at relatively low cost, went on to gobble up all of Europe, kill vast numbers of people, both by genocide and by war, and when we finally did have to stop him, it was at great, great cost. So the real problem is not do we prefer peace over war, but what kind of peace will it be, and how do we achieve it with the least cost in blood and treasure? Kathleen, we should talk about the Eurozone.
You know, I was thinking about that. I would like to get to that. The Prime Minister of Poland said that the crisis is reaching worrisome levels. Do you agree with that?
I think he's exactly right. Do you want a quick sort of 1 euro, 50 cent team? What would normally happen when a country faces the problems that, say, Greece faces today, is it would devalue its currency and impose some austerity. Some of its debts would be written down by the people to whom they're owed, just like when you owe more on your house than you can pay, you default on it, or the bank writes part of it down, and you eat part of it, and the bank eats part of it, and so forth. But in the Eurozone, you can't do that. Why can't you do that? Because just like Wisconsin can't write down its debts by devaluing the Wisconsin dollar relative to the dollar in New York and California and Illinois, you can't, once you've locked into a single euro currency, you can't devalue it. So one possibility would be that Greece pulls out of the Eurozone. The problem with that is that once it pulls out, the other countries that are vulnerable, Italy, Spain, Portugal, and Ireland, would all come under tremendous pressure, because now people recognize, well, you can pull out of the Eurozone and devalue and take a lot of write-down on these debts. Won't those countries be the next to fall? The other problem is that just like a lot of banks in the U.S. own mortgage debt and so forth, and if you write that debt down, then those banks would be in trouble that own this debt. So if you allow that debt to be fully written down, then some of those banks might go under, and that would have big reverberation through the system. The point is, the banks that bought that debt ought to pay the price, right? I mean, in other words, they're profit-making institutions, or intend to be. If they make a mistake, they ought to pay the price like the rest of us do when we make mistakes. But the people who run the whole economic system are so wary of what the system-wide effects would be of big banks falling, that they're unwilling to do that. So that's the short answer to why there's such a deep crisis.
We go to, for sure, one more phone call. Joe from Lafarge. Hi, Joe.
Hi, this is just a rhetorical question, and I know the answer's not going to be positive, but I was listening, you know, with all this intrigue going on and trying to control everything in the Mideast and in different parts of the world, wouldn't it be better for everybody if we just pulled out of there and took that energy and put it into trying to develop alternative sources of energy in this country?
I don't think that's a rhetorical question. I think that there's a big feeling in the country that agrees with you, Joe, that we should, or at least on the backing out of there, that we should have a much lower footprint. Frankly, I think that that's what President Obama came in to office with, that as a theme. And I think that the leading from behind in Libya was part of that, the idea that we would try to engage diplomatically rather than militarily a number of these countries is also a part of that. There are some countries where we're afraid that having a very low footprint could lead to really bad problems. Pakistan's tribal regions is one such area. We clearly don't want to have boots on the ground there, but we're afraid that if the bad guys take take complete control there, they not only will hurt us in Afghanistan, but they could potentially end up with control of nuclear weapons that Pakistan has. The issue on green energy is something that I know Kathleen has done a lot of programs on, and I'll leave that as a separate question for where we should put the resources that we save from having a lower military footprint.
And how much money are we going to save from having a lower military footprint?
That's an interesting question. The real problem that people trying to think about the military budget have going forward is the following. We face two real kinds of threats in the world, and they entail very different kinds of military.
We have about 20 seconds, too.
The military that you build to deal with, you build drones and so forth to deal with, these are tribes that are trying to take down the World Trade Center or something like that. The other is something like the Chinese, and for them you have to build a different kind of military. So it remains to be seen, but we're definitely cutting back on the military because we need the money for all of the other social programs.
Thanks for covering so much territory, Professor Lipson.
Thank you so much, Kathleen. I love it.
Good. We love having you. Professor Charles Lipson, Professor of International Relations at the University of Chicago. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Chrissy Pease for production. We'll be back.